I'm Vicky Mochama, and this is No Little Plans, a podcast about the UN Sustainable Development Goals in Canada. The future of our planet is kind of a big question mark, and that is terrifying. The general consensus is that we've messed up, and now we're rushing to save ourselves. But to keep up with all the news of global environmental disasters, freak weather, warming oceans, and species at the brink of extinction is no small feat.
There could be fires of the kind we're seeing in Australia, in many other places.
In this city in southern Iran, many were killed, and nearly 100 others were injured by flash floods.
They're angry and they're disappointed. There's no hope for them.
The floodwaters had swallowed up the landmarks on their maps.
And we can't talk about climate change without also addressing all the feelings it's brought up. From anxiety to anger to hope to hopelessness. Because how do you inspire change or keep a conversation going if you're paralyzed by emotions? Even the people leading the conversations are not immune.
So when I was 11, I became ill. I fell into depression. I stopped talking and I stopped eating. In 2 months, I lost about 10 kilos of weight. Later on, I was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, OCD, and selective mutism. That basically means I only speak when I think it's necessary. Now was one of those moments.
That's Greta Thunberg, the environmental activist who took over the world with powerful words and calls to action. Greta helped start the Global Youth Climate Strike, which saw millions of young people and adults across the globe step out of school and work to demand change. Greta talks about her fear and anger and how it fuels her activism. She's not alone. People around the world are coming to terms with the reality of the climate crisis, including its psychological toll. Researchers have started to use a specific term to describe this. It's called ecological grief.
Ecological grief is the grief, the sadness, the pain that people feel in connection to the loss of something that isn't human. So it can be a species, it can be a body of water, it can be a singular animal, it can be a beloved place.
That's Ashley Consolo. Ashley is the director of the Laboratory Institute of Memorial University. She researches how climate change impacts mental health, and she was one of the researchers who helped coin the term over 10 years ago.
I first started working in northern Labrador in the Nunatsiavut land claim settlement region. This region is rapidly changing in terms of temperature warming and sea ice loss. So the community was already experiencing health impacts and they wanted to have a better sense of what was happening.
Northern Labrador is one of the fastest warming places on the planet. For 2 years, Ashley and her team spent time with the communities, listened to their stories, spoke to their elders. By the end of it, they had interviewed around 100 people.
One of the people that we worked with up north described it as kind of a grief without end. So she was linking it to losing someone and how you never forget them, you love them constantly, and you're kind of changed by this grief. But then she talked about the changes that they're seeing up north daily. So, you know, if it's shifts in temperature, sea ice, that daily there are changes. And so every day you're kind of confronted with this sense of loss, but it's not ever quite over. And in 2014, we released a documentary with voices from all 5 Inuit communities in the Nunatsiavut region. And there's so many beautiful quotes, but there's one at the end where Tony Anderson, he was the Angiyukok, and that means mayor. So he was the mayor of the community of Nain. And he said, you know, Inuit are people of the sea ice. And if we don't have sea ice, how can we be people of the sea ice? And that is such a powerful example of what is happening. So if you have people whose identity for thousands of years has been connected to the sea ice, that culture and life and food and language and family, everything emerges from the land and the ice. What happens when there's no more sea ice? What we're talking about here is not just grief and anxiety, but it's this loss of those things that are intangible. And in the climate change literature, they call this intangible loss and damages. So things that are almost unseen, that they can't be measured, the value can't be put on them, but they are so important and so prevalent.
What are the ways that ecological grief is different and similar to other types of grief?
Often this grief is something that you choose not to talk about. So it's not like when you lose a loved one, societies have structures around that. You know, we have rituals, we have funerals, you can take bereavement leave, people come around you, they support you, people bring food. And so there's these structures in place to make you feel less alone and more connected. What we were finding when it was around ecological grief and loss is that people almost felt alone. They felt sometimes embarrassed, sometimes ashamed to talk about it. And a lot of people just said they didn't know the language. Like, how do you bring it up? How do you bring that you're grieving for an ecosystem, or you're grieving for a body of water, or you're concerned about the future of sea ice?
It's interesting that you talk about the feeling that people were felt that they were isolated in their grief when the changes in the climate are happening to their, you know, to their wider community, to a much larger landscape. Can you talk to us about that experience of people feeling isolated, even though it's kind of happening to everybody?
10 years ago, this wasn't in the public conversation. There was hardly any research about it, and in fact, very, very little at that time. So I think it's something that a lot of people were feeling, and I certainly think that ecological grief isn't new. I mean, I think there are people for hundreds of years that and thousands of years who have been deeply connected to the environment. But what started to happen in our research was as people started to talk about their emotions and talked about the mental impacts, more and more people started to say, hey, I feel that way too. Or, you know, I didn't think anyone else did. I thought I was the only one. And so I think what started to happen was more and more people just started to talk about it, not only in Northern Labrador, but also all over.
In 2016, Ashley started working with her colleague, Dr. Neville Ellis, all the way from across the globe in Perth, Australia. He was also looking at how climate change affects mental health, but instead of remote communities in Northern Labrador, his research focused on farmers in long-term drought-affected areas.
And so we started to compare the voices and the stories and the experiences. And what was amazing was, you know, two different, vastly different geographic regions, different parts of the world, different cultural backgrounds, different temperatures and climates, and people were saying virtually the same thing. So we started to characterize how people are responding and what they're saying around ecological grief and do this sort of cross-country comparison.
Is there a anxiety or grief about climate that happens to people who aren't maybe directly experiencing it? You know, I live in Toronto, and I wouldn't say that it's easy to point out where climate change is particularly hitting us. You know, we don't see the landscape change in that way. Is there sort of like a grief that people feel about it when they're not necessarily seeing the land or the weather change?
Yeah, that's something that people ask about all the time. And it's really interesting because there are, you know, if you're at the forefront of acute climate change experiences, so things like hurricanes, wildfires, flooding, obviously people are experiencing a whole variety of physical and mental and emotional impacts. And then there's that slower kind of cumulative thing that we've been talking about more up north, where we're seeing changing sea ice, changing temperature. So that kind of ongoing thing that's bringing a lot of grief and anxiety. But what's really interesting is a third area is things around what we call anticipatory or vicarious grief. So anticipatory grief is the grief that you can feel no matter where you are about what's coming. And this is something that people talk all over, whether they're at the front lines of a changing climate yet or not, is this idea that, you know, we hear the science, we hear what's coming, we read the reports. And so this generalized sense of anxiety, of fear, of sadness, of grief around what is coming for the world.
So the various UN reports saying, you know, by 2100, we're going to have a very different climate, or by, you know, in the next 12 years, there's a ticking clock on what we can and can't do. All of that stuff contributes to what you're calling anticipatory grief.
Yes, absolutely. And things like the United Nations Biodiversity Report that came out in the spring, where, you know, they identified 1 million species being at risk for extinction. This sense of anticipatory loss is becoming stronger and stronger. And you see this, people talking about it all the time, is what motivates them. And I find that a lot of people who live, as you say, in Toronto or in other urban settings where maybe they are not experiencing the changes of climate change quite so abruptly as other places, are starting to really think about this and starting to really worry and thinking, okay, you know, do we have 5 years? Do we have 10 years? What's our window for acting?
Does addressing climate grief and climate anxiety, is it therapeutic for people to do so? Or do you find that people are then, you know, stuck in their grief?
There is always a danger with any sort of strong emotional experiences like grief, like anxiety, that it can be very isolating and very immobilizing and very debilitating. But what we know from other mental health research and from professional counselors and from the mental health field is that confronting the emotions in a supportive environment, in a way that helps you talk about them, that helps you make sense of all of what you're feeling, of feeling not alone, of connecting with others, is very important to overall mental health and wellness and does have a therapeutic value. What's really interesting about grief is there's a lot of kind of research that looks at how grief, although it's painful and although it can be deeply devastating, also has this really unique capacity to bring people together. So we all know what it is like to grieve. No one comes into this world and doesn't know what it's like to lose someone at some point. So there's this automatic kind of human connection and empathy that we all have, where we think, okay, we know what it feels like to lose someone or something that we love. So when we see other people in pain, there's this innate ability to connect. And so in other social movements and other places in the world, grief has been a powerful motivating force that brings people together in a way that, you know, other emotions don't necessarily do, and in a way that can be really powerful if we figure out how to deal with the grief and deal with the anxiety in a positive and productive way that doesn't make people feel isolated or like they can't act.
Earlier, we talked about Greta, who's now been named Time Magazine's Person of the Year for 2019. But we can't talk about Greta without also mentioning Autumn Peltier. Autumn is a 15-year-old water protector from Wukumikong First Nation on Manitoulin Island in northern Ontario. Her activism began when she realized how many Indigenous communities in Canada still do not have access to clean drinking water. In September, she spoke at the Global Landscapes Forum, which is dedicated to achieving the Sustainable Development Goals.
Our first water teaching comes from within our own mother. We literally live in water for 9 months, floating in that sacred water that gives us life. We can't live in our mother's womb without water. As a fetus, we need that sacred water for development. The sacred significance is that my mother comes from her mother's water, my grandmother comes from her mother's water, and my great-great-grandmother comes from her mother's water.
Young people like Autumn Peltier have started to take matters into their own hands, and the world is finally beginning to notice. But climate change doesn't affect everyone equally. For many, climate change is still felt as a looming presence. But for many Indigenous peoples, it's already here, and it is affecting their lives on a daily basis. I talked to Hillary McGregor, a 22-year-old youth coordinator at Indigenous Sport and Wellness in Ontario. He helped to develop a leadership program for Indigenous youth in Canada called the Standing Bear Program. And he told me that the key to his work is letting Indigenous youth be the ones who have a say.
We asked youth what they wanted to learn, and one of the big ones was language.
Mm.
Just from an identity perspective, you need to have a good sense of identity in order to lead. So I decided I wanted to go back and try and learn that so that I can help other youth to learn it later.
Yeah.
We don't have a word for leadership in our language. We have words to describe what leaders do, or good leaders. And often it relates to things like the heart. Somebody who's strong-hearted or good-hearted would be a leader. And also it teaches you a bit about how we lived. When you think about how leadership was in our communities, it wasn't always just one leader. People would take on leadership roles depending on circumstance.
Mm.
So it changes how we view our program. We need to make sure that it was really broad to allow for youth to take on leadership roles in different areas. It's not just speaking up and being on chief and council. That can be one aspect of leadership, but not the only thing. And then the other thing that it teaches us is about the land, actually. So that's kind of how we relate it to things like climate change. Our language is very land-based. And the word land is in a lot of our other words. For example, to teach is a word is kinamage. The word for land is ki. So in order to teach, you need to know the land.
I asked Hillary what he was hearing from youth around the subject of climate change.
In many cases, it's a state of crisis. Communities like Kaseshawan, which floods almost yearly. This year, there was a flood in Bearskin Lake, and the community had to evacuate. And I think it was either last year or the year before, there were the series of wildfires.
Yep.
That went through a number of our communities as well. So communities also had to evacuate. So when you hear from kids, they're talking about states of crisis or emergency in their communities. So I think in some ways we're a bit past the eco grief. We're at the state of crisis now. But I think When we articulate and we talk about it with youth, communication needs to be very solutions focused, just because they see the impacts daily in a lot of these cases, and they're experiencing crisis already. So they're not really questioning whether or not climate change is happening. They want to know what are the solutions going to be? How can I contribute now to make things better for my community?
Can you tell us what that might feel like when you know, there's maybe a disconnect between people who are saying, wow, it's going to be so bad, and Indigenous youth who are saying, no, it's already really bad. What does that feel like for Indigenous youth from your perspective?
Well, personally, I'm fortunate enough that I haven't felt the same crisis in my community yet. So it's not the same for me. But when I go to these communities and I hear from the youth, I think there's a big disconnect, because you get government agencies. There used to be the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change in Ontario. I'm not sure if they exist anymore, or they might have a different name now. So they used to come into communities and they'd have their climate change solutions and solutions for the future, things like the carbon tax. And there's a disconnect with the youth, because they're treating people in our communities, and youth in particular, as though they are not experts. They need to be educated on climate change, but they're already experiencing it. So in a lot of ways, they are more the expert than some of the scientists who are coming in. So there's a disconnect. And I'll give you an example. A few years ago, I was in Thunder Bay at a youth gathering there on climate change. And so the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change was there, and they were talking about the carbon tax, and they were talking about community gardens and food security, and all those are good. There's nothing wrong with doing that. But there's a disconnect, because the youth wanted to be out on the land more. They wanted to hunt moose, they wanted to fish more, and they wanted the water to be clean. But a community garden's not going to fix that. It's just going to give them vegetables instead of eating the fish. So there's a disconnect, right? They don't feel like they're being heard. And in many ways, their climate change solutions are much more drastic than what's being proposed.
Like what?
They wanted stricter regulations on industry in and around their communities. They didn't want, you know, things like mines coming in. And I'll give you some examples of that. So right now, I heard from somebody in Saugeen, First Nation, and they're talking about Nuclear Waste Management Ontario. I'm pretty sure that's the name. They want to put nuclear waste under their community. And so there's a consultation process to do environmental impact assessments. But the required amount of community members to vote in favor is very minimal. And it just needs to be just over 50% of the population that does vote needs to vote yes in order for it to go through. So there's a lot of these processes that are created by government. In my community, we just recently had an election on land claim settlements. Our population's about 1,500. We needed 500 people to vote. 51% needed to vote yes for the land claim settlement. And in within this land claim settlement, you are relinquishing your rights indefinitely to the land. And so if the community votes no, there is a second election, and you only need 200 community members to vote. Just over 100 of them need to vote yes. So just over 100 out of 1,500 people need to vote yes for this to go through. So that's very, very minimal. So these processes are not democratic at all, and in fact promote kind of the loss of land, the loss of title to land. So there's a lot of these processes that are very, very biased, and youth know this. And so they want to kind of reform the whole process, right? But of course, government doesn't want to do that.
Hillary reminds us about the disconnect and gaps between science, policy, and the Indigenous youth experiencing climate change on the front lines. I wanted to learn what it would look like to prioritize an Indigenous framework when dealing with climate change. I reached out to Professor Deborah McGregor. She's actually Hillary's mother. She's an associate professor and the Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Environmental Justice at York University's Osgoode Hall. I asked her what she's seen when it comes to how Indigenous peoples, especially youth and elders, are feeling when it comes to climate change.
I think a number of things. For sure, there's grief, but that's longstanding. Like, people are grieving since colonization 500 or so years ago, depending on where you are in the Americas. But I think part of it is also frustration that you know, they're not being listened to. And so everyone in the world is also now facing their annihilation. So they're in a panic, and then it's a crisis. But it's been a crisis for a long time. So, but Indigenous peoples have managed to survive and been resilient and adapted over that. So maybe there's something that we can offer other people about how to survive and how to work through a lot of this. And eventually you do have to do something. Like you have to act on what you know.
I talked to Deborah about the idea of ecological grief and the value of naming the psychological impact of climate change.
I think it's important to name it because people are feeling it and people are a lot more sympathetic to grief, right? It's sort of like, oh, well, they're grieving. And the thing about grief when people are feeling it is that it's hard to say to someone, I kind of know what you're going through, because you really don't, right? So they kind of have to work through it themselves, right? And it's kind of hard to say to someone, yeah, you'll feel better in whatever X number of months. And that's just not, I think, how hope might work. Mm-hmm. So where do we turn this around to being able to do something about our future and to future generations? What kind of things can we do that will enable people to have some kind of hope, some kind of path out of this? Because we got here somehow. So what's that pathway to get out of it?
What are some things that you see giving you hope when it comes to communities or people managing or dealing with their own sense of grief?
For us, the way that we've been able to adapt and be resilient is through our own traditions, through our own language, through being able to live on the land, having that direct connection, being able to actually not only like live on land sustainably, but actually learn from it itself. Like what is the earth trying to tell us? Because in our stories too, we've had to face our end. We've had to face our annihilation. And that's what gets us out of it, is this ability to be able to understand and learn from the land, the waters and everything else, and figure out how to live with that sustainably. Because we weren't perfect. We made mistakes. And usually learning from them meant that we had to behave appropriately. So being able to enable youth to be able to learn that, to practice it, and for it to become part of their education, to strengthen their identity and just their skill set for survival, those are things, activities that are happening more and more on the ground in communities, I think, that are kind of leading us towards that solution.
Paint for me what our current world could look like if Indigenous ways of knowledge were more embedded.
I think, one, you would have a different governance system. You would have different people running it, because you tend to show up to these kind of global meetings at, like, on the outside being the protesters or the marginalized voice, but you're not part of that kind of decision making. So to me, the governance system would have to change. There'd have to be different laws. So what's starting to emerge now is the rights of nature, the legal personhood of nature. What happened if you couldn't do that to the planet? So Indigenous peoples who got together in 2010 in Bolivia came out with the Rights of Mother Earth Declaration. So those are starting to become part of the conversation, where nature or the planet is not commodity. But Indigenous knowledges have the long thousands of years of knowledge of, if you do this, this is what's going to happen. And people have been saying that, and it hasn't been listened to. People haven't been ready to hear that, even with youth. So I find there's like the tokenistic, let's listen to youth, and maybe they can give their 15-minute speech at the UN or whatever it is. But I'm like, well, that's not influencing decision making. So how can youth like actually be part of decision making and meaningfully, as opposed to being on the outside, giving a presentation, everyone goes, oh yeah, that's so heartwarming, and then proceeds on the way they've always been doing things. That's kind of what I see there. And no one wants to hear this. You don't believe how unpopular this is when I say this in circles, is that maybe we have to accept the fact that we're not going to be as materially wealthy as we have been. Maybe we have to let it go and just go, for our future generations, we don't want them to have a bunch of stuff. Maybe they don't get to have a house and three cars and all these trips that require planes all over the world. Like, we actually want them to live more simply and sustainably. And that's like mortifying, because most people want their kids to have like more stuff, want them to have more things. That never goes well, but that's generally what you're going to have to do.
Tell me why that doesn't go well. I know it sounds obvious, but, you know, what's the reaction that you get when you say to people, there has to be less, your kids won't have the wealth you have if we want to go forward?
If we want to be sustainable, if they are actually going to have like some kind of reasonable future. I think because it's a very materialistic, consumer-oriented society, people want stuff and they're not really prepared to give that up. I think from an Indigenous perspective, it's slightly, well, it is different, because when you're already poor to begin with and you don't have stuff, you do want better for your kids, because people don't even have a place to live. People don't even have drinking water. But that's not most of society. Most of Canadian society is fairly privileged and are fairly urban, even though there's major inequities in that. So I find that the people who are the most appalled by that idea are the ones who have the most. I grew up not, we didn't have running water or electricity. I know where to get water. I know how to do things that other people would just be totally lost. Yeah. Like I tell my kids, I can live without nothing, because I did. So I think it's really hard, because we're really ingrained in a development model, like the development model that everything has to be better, and the better is generally consuming. People don't see better as being having a better relationship with the planet itself, which means we need to stop taking from it. That's a very different way of thinking about one's relationship to the natural world and to the future. How do we stop taking so much?
Maybe it's time we took a step back and listen to the people that climate change is affecting directly and learn from them. We are past the point of figuring it out as we go. Speaking to our guests is a reminder of how eco-grief is by no means new. Acknowledging it and naming it, however, is an important step in accepting how climate change threatens our well-being. Whether on the front lines, shorelines, or in urban centers, climate change puts stress on people's mental health. But of course, this stress is not equally distributed, and climate change disproportionately affects the most vulnerable, the young, and the marginalized. The same people who are leading the way forward in this conversation and providing meaningful solutions to addressing climate change. I'm Vicky Mochama, and this has been No Little Plans, a podcast from Community Foundations of Canada. Our producers are Dorsa Islami, Jay Coburn, and Allie Payne-Smith. And our executive producer is Katie Jensen. Our music is by Elcon, and the show is a project of Strategic Content Labs, Canada's content marketing consultancy. If you want to learn more about the SDGs, go to alliance2030.ca. It's a website created by Community Foundations of Canada to track SDG efforts by communities across Canada. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, subscribe, and share, as it helps other people find the show. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at No Little Podcast. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts and join us as we look at the big plan to reshape the world.